Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. This is the second part of the Richard Rohr conversation, which you're going to love. And if you're thinking to yourself, I'm enjoying listening to Richard Rohr, but I would really love a chance to watch him in video format do some of this teaching. Well, guess what? I've got the opportunity for you. Our friends over at the Work of the People video series have done a ton of interviews, conversations with Richard Rohr, among other people you would recognize. People like N.T. Wright, Walter Brueggemann, Barbara Brown Taylor, Brene Brown, a lot of great people. I would highly encourage you to go check out their work. I've personally used their material in sermons and for my own spiritual progress. So I would encourage you to go to workofthepeople.com, check it out there. Also, we'll have a link on our website as well as our Facebook page. And if you haven't liked us on Facebook, Newsworthy or Norrisworthy Podcast, you need to do that. So go there. You can find more information about the Work of the People, which I think you're going to really enjoy, guys. So without further ado, here it is, the second part of the Richard Rohr podcast. Let's do it. Okay, I want to change gears here.
Okay.
So I finally picked up a copy of your book on the Enneagram.
Oh.
Not too long. And I feel like I say the word wrong every time.
No, you said it right.
Enneagram. And I don't know a whole lot, so I've read your book.
Did you?
And so that's like the only thing I know about the Enneagram. I've heard people talk about it in kind of my circles. I'm shamed that I don't really know the Enneagram because it's kind of like a code of honor. Like, so what number are you?
Really?
Yeah.
Even? Oh.
No, it's not that bad. I'm being facetious to some degree. But so I'm wondering, as someone who's been using the Enneagram for decades, right?
73, I learned it. Yeah. 1973. You weren't born yet.
Almost. Just a decade away. No, so you've been doing it longer than I've been alive.
Yeah.
I've got a friend who is a chiropractor, and he says that he can watch people walk and say, I know what's wrong with your spine and your shoulders tight and your hamstrings tight, or you know your ankles don't have good flexion or something. And he can just look at people and pinpoint, okay, this is what you are. Do you do the same thing with the Enneagram? Like you can just see someone talking and go, you're number two, you're number seven.
If I'm with them a half an hour, I almost always know.
How long have we been talking now? Oh, no.
I'm not certain of you, but I guess. And see, originally what it was precisely that. Training you as a spiritual director. That's what it served as for maybe as much as 1,000 years. To train the spiritual eye of a spiritual director so you could focus in on what the person really needed to pay attention to. And that became the Christian capital sins. Now, we had seven capital sins.
Did we just add two to that?
That's it. There were two that we missed. The Enneagram, Ennea in Greek, means nine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the nine words or the nine types, the nine passions, if you will. Passion doesn't mean blindness is the way they use the word. It's the only people who don't think the Enneagram is true are people who don't know it. Once you know it, it's so obviously true. Why it's true, I can't prove it, and I've known it. I gave the keynote address last summer for the 40th anniversary of the entrance of the Enneagram into America. And a room filled with people who believe in it, and we all know it's true, but we don't know why. And
it's crazy to think that there are nine types and are billions of people.
People.
But there's only nine types.
Yeah.
That kind of blows my mind.
Well, remember this. There's 1,000 ways to be each, to be a six.
With the wings, right?
We use just numbers, yeah. I mean, once you've typed, you're like, I'm a one, the first type. Okay, you know what to pay attention to and the direction in which your fault lies. And it's overwhelmingly obvious, mm-hmm. if you're honest. But I know ones who are very different than me. And yet I can still see the underlying game is the same.
It's the same game.
It's the same. Like in my case, it's a search for perfection. That's why we often make good teachers, why I can talk here with some ease. We're looking for the perfect word to communicate our perfect idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes us very clear teachers. Ones very often are teachers. It's amazing.
Really?
Yeah. But we can also, now the dark side of that, I'll just use, is we can be school marms in the negative connotation of that term, sort of moralistic and finger shaking and on time, little Boy Scouts. I was a little Boy Scout.
Were you?
On time, reverent, respectful, yes sir, no sir, got through the seminary with no trouble. That's the way ones are. We're little adults. I was an adult at a 10-year-old boy, as a 10-year-old boy.
I told you before we started recording about my daughter, my 6-year-old daughter. Yes. I told her, hey, I'm going to go to the beach in a couple of weeks. You want to come with me? And she says, yes. I said, well, you have to skip school. And she goes, I can't skip school.
Yeah.
That sounds like a one response. She's
now,
an oldest
now,
child.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Is she very responsible?
She's more responsible than I am.
I bet she's a one. That's my energy.
She wakes me up to get her to school. She wakes me up. She's six.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
So she's a one.
No, I don't want to say for certain.
Okay, but
if she were here after you've given me that much, I'd know within 5 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a home, and again, you don't want to type her, tell her you're a one. You're just her daddy. But this is going to help you understand her because, especially when she gets a little older, she's going to start being very hard on herself.
You know,
and you're going to have to never accentuate those voices in her because she'll overdo it. You don't need to be moralistic with her at all because she's going to be way too moralistic with herself.
On her own. Yeah. And so that's part of how the tool is used.
That's right.
I love what you're doing for parents because I can see my oldest daughter's one way. My second daughter, she's three. She's not like that. She would skip school every day. Like she wouldn't go to her Mother's Day Out thing because she wants to stay at home in her pajamas. But they're different. And so it'd be easy for me as a parent to think, well, this worked for oldest child, so let me do the same thing to the middle child.
Excellent.
But instead, this helps me ask different questions.
Yeah.
My wife and I ask different questions.
You know, let me add on to that. You're right down the right alley. People think the Enneagram is going to make you put people in boxes. It exactly has the opposite effect. By knowing already, these are completely two different energies, my first two daughters, I'm going to treat them very differently, you know?
Yeah.
Your second probably will need a little discipline, a little boundary putting here and there. Whereas your first daughter is never, she's going to create boundaries for herself that are probably too strict.
That makes perfect sense.
That's what I was as a little boy. I was on time for everything. My parents never worried about me. I walked the other little kids in the neighborhood home from school because all the neighbor mothers knew that little Dickie Roar could be relied upon in all situations, and I could be.
Yeah.
But by the second half of life, that which served me well as a boy started rotting. Did I say that in the book? It's like, Richard, you're too much of a Boy Scout. You're starting to become stern and overly moral and overly right.
Mm-hmm.
The most common phrase that a one uses, watch this in your daughter, is, that's not right. That's not right.
Yes.
Does she already use it? We see when things aren't right. We know what the rules are. Most religious reformers, Luther, Calvin, Knox.
Roar.
They're all ones.
Yeah.
Because we're moral people, and we see when religion isn't living up to its own criteria.
Yeah. Now, you did say, speaking of being on the right path, you said that N.T. Wright is a seven.
Yes.
And you guessed that
because he told me that. I'm not outing him. But at this little conference we were at together years ago, I noticed how fun-loving he was. And, of course, I respected him as such a scholar.
Yeah.
And he already knew the Enneagram. This was 12, 15 years ago. He said, oh, I'm a seven. Can't you tell? And I said, yeah, I think I can tell. And go ahead with what you're...
Well, I really just wanted to be recorded where you said I was like N.T. Wright. That's really what I was fishing for.
Not the seven part. You have the sparkling eyes of a seven. Your smile is very natural, and you're fun-loving. Now, I could be wrong, but I would say I'm 80%...
A seven, huh?
Thinking... You're a seven,
okay, well,
but I'm willing to be unconvinced.
Well, yeah. I don't know.
Oh, you don't know. Okay.
Well, I read your book, and your suggestion in the book was not to go through a questionnaire, which you find all over the internet. You said just to read them all and see which fits you.
Well, the best thing is to be with a mentor or spiritual director who knows it, and they can usually affirm it for you within a half an hour.
Yeah.
But only in dialogue with you, and you've got to come to the conclusion.
Yeah.
Like, I did the wrong thing by saying you're probably a seven.
Well,
because you might not be.
I felt at home as a three.
All right. That was my second choice.
Well, I read some of that and I thought, yeah, but I don't want to admit that.
Was that more humiliating?
Well, it wasn't humiliating. I thought, okay, this makes sense. But then, like, you're describing, you're like, well, they're very shallow. And they just kind of...
You're not shallow.
They act and they do whatever they can to impress people. I'm like, oh, this is a terrible number to be.
Oh, gosh. I mean, you might be... Is one of your parents real positive? Or
yeah, my dad's a very optimistic person.
Oh, that's the seven I'm seeing in you. I'm seeing your dad in you. Because right behind the seven was the three. The way you arranged this meeting, that you would travel here, and you asked nothing of us, you rented the car, you came here, you got the flight, you set up, that's all immense three behavior.
What do you mean by that?
Threes grease the wheels of everything to make it more efficient and more effective.
Hmm.
And they do it almost effortlessly, like you did this meeting.
Hmm.
Like I said, can't we just talk on the phone? You didn't. They don't mind expending energy. Like you wasted a whole day.
It's not wasted.
Coming here.
But it's better. Yeah, like, this is better to do it this way.
If it's better, you will put yourself out for it.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to say you might well be a three. You're also, please don't be embarrassed by this, but you're a good-looking man. And I would like to know myself, what is this that most threes I've ever met are good-looking? It's almost as if, as a little boy, I'm sure you were a cute little boy, you cute little kids, I'm sorry to say, get more response from adults. And people look at them, smile at them, reach out to them. And they seem to develop self-confidence much earlier, which is three.
But it also shapes... There's no way I can say this next thing without sounding like a terrible person. Okay, so this is awful. Like I really, I'm going to edit this out. But it goes as a conversation. So when I was just transferred to college, there was like some rumor that I was a model for Abercrombie & Fitch. And there was a phone call or two or something. And so... Like I go to a college of 4,000 people, a new guy comes in there. They say this about him, this popular clothing company. Oh, this is and it creates a dynamic where people expect something, and you're expected to be something, and you get used to that. And
that's what I'm saying. You just said it.
It changes the relationships you have, and
it's called lookism.
And I hate that I just said that story. Please forgive me. Can you absolve me?
You're probably helping a whole bunch of threes out there. Because most threes suffer from this, that they realize ever since their childhood, they've gotten more than they deserved response. And this has given them an excess of self-confidence. Now, just as a spiritual director, I'm going to say, God is using that, all right? So I got my thing and my fix in another direction, that I was responsible, dutiful, and...
But that's a good thing. Like, this is just shallow, like, oh, wow.
Well, no, it really... It can be.
Yeah.
A lot of threes, I mean, Hollywood is filled with threes, good-looking young men and beautiful women who just try to live on that level all their life. Can you imagine why they become drug addicts and alcoholics when they're not so beautiful anymore?
Well, when you're not young.
Or when you're not young. It all depends on youth.
It's gone. And you don't have that anymore.
There you go. So I hope I said in the book, I can't remember, it's been so many years, but... You know, if deceit is the worst fault of a three, love of truth, getting beyond the bullshit, is the great gift of a three. Just, I want to have integrity. I want to do this with truth. And I have some very dear three friends. And that's what characterizes them. They like integrity. They like truthfulness. And they see through phoniness because they played that game or they're tempted to play that game. Do you see? So every time your sin is your gift is your sin. You can't have one without the other. They're two sides literally of the same coin.
Yeah.
I can see why you're fascinated by it because the Enneagram teaches you non-dual thinking.
Because it's not just good, it's not just bad.
There you go. Like righteousness is my worst fault. But a love of justice and honesty is my greatest gift.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
And here, so you could be in your worst just living the fashion model game. But at your truth, though, you don't need that. And you don't want that. And you don't want people to love you. The fear inside of a good-looking person very often is, would people love me if I were not? And very often they'll try not to play on that to see if people love them apart from their appearance. Women, I think, good-looking women have to suffer from
this.
Yeah,
that's got to be
immensely. Because they realize man after man wants them just for their body or their face.
Yeah. I'm in deep regret that I even brought this up.
No, I'm glad you did. You were vulnerable about a little bit of yourself, and that's going to help other people be vulnerable too. I wouldn't delete it.
No one better tweet me about that. Okay, I will block you. Yeah. Okay, there's a movie out recently called Birdman, which was a very popular movie. Did really well. Yeah. And it's about an actor. And so I just read the Enneagram stuff about being a number three, being an actor. And so I watched this movie about this insecure actor who is struggling to find identity and worth, and his ex-wife says this line to him that stuck me. She said to the actor who's trying to figure out who he is, and he's going to eventually, well, I'm not going to ruin the movie, but he's struggling. And she says to him, "You've always confused adoration for love."
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh, that's a three, right?
It could be a three. It could be an easy response for a three, yeah. Now, are you speaking of it from which side? Wanting to be adored?
Yeah, you want adoration and you think that's what you want when really you're wanting love. And you mistake what real love is and you just are satisfied with adoration.
That's excellent. Yes.
There's a lot of... I have a handful of friends who are pastors who are also threes. And there seems to be something about being a pastor that at a young age when you're like a preacher boy... Everyone loves a preacher boy because it's cute and it's nice. Oh, this is a young man who's doing the right thing. And so everyone tells you how wonderful you are.
Yes,
that can lure you into the ministry because everyone loves for people to tell them how great they are.
Do you know there was a study of narcissistic occupations? You probably know what I'm going to say. And the number one occupation that attracted the most narcissistic personalities was the clergy.
Really?
For the very reasons you said. When you're up in front of a crowd, Sunday after Sunday, we dress up even in vestments.
I'm so jealous of that.
And people are, looking upon us as godly men. You've got to know that is a huge inflation to the ego.
Yeah.
And if you don't have some, this is why so many priests and ministers get in sexual problems, because this constantly, you said it well, being adored almost, just highly inflates the ego.
What is the connection to sex then?
Well, this need to be adored morphs over into sexuality. This woman who I see is sitting in the front pew just worshiping my every word. I want to build on that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to groom that and lead it further to get my own needs met. I'm not saying this is true anywhere, the majority of clergy, but it happens enough to know that we got a problem, that there's a danger in speaking for God. When you speak for God, this does terrible things to the youthful male soul that makes him think he's far more along the path than very often he really is.
So what do you encourage that person to do to fight against that?
Didn't I say this on Oprah? I'll repeat it for you. When she was asking me, I said, the main thing you got to take advantage of is notice how you respond to offenses and people who don't like you. If you need to overly assert, I was right, you're wrong, you're wrong to think ill of me, you're still probably trapped in the ego self. So we need, I really mean this, we need to be offended at least once a day. We need not to get our own way at least once a day. Now, this is where it's good to be a married man. No, it is. It is. It is, because your wife is going to make sure of that, and your children are going to make sure of that.
Yes, really. Very much so.
My position is much more dangerous. I don't have a wife. I don't have children. I don't have those truth speakers that keep my feet on the ground like you do. But if you don't, if you keep yourself superior to your wife, mm-hmm. and she never can speak truth to you, honey, you aren't very loving today. You know, as I'm sure a wife says sometimes to a husband.
I've heard that from other people.
you've got to watch your response. Is it overly defensive? That reveals to you how much you're attached to your egoic self.
Hmm.
To your narcissism.
So you learn to be at peace with people critiquing you and not having to defend yourself. Mm-hmm.
And you know that several
times. That's not easy.
No, it isn't. It isn't easy. You know, and you and I, for probably different reasons, are used to being adored. When that becomes daily, anybody who doesn't adore me, I'm just, well, what's wrong with you that you don't know? So we especially need it, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But the very fact, Luke, that you could ask the question so honestly, you'll be okay. I'm not worried about you. It's the guys who would never think of asking that question. Hmm. They're so convinced that they deserve all this adulation and all this praise. Those are the ones you're worried about.
Yeah, like you were saying about being married, I've been married for 12 years now.
12 years.
And there's no way I can be married that long and really think I'm half as good as people think I am. Mm-hmm. Like, I really, Luke, you've got some stuff to work on, you know?
Mm-hmm. See?
So,
marriage is the safest vocation by far, because you provide a mirror for one another. Mm-hmm. That even though you love one another, you clearly show one another that you're not perfect yet.
Very, very much so. Very much so. Yeah. Well, how does a marriage work where you are allowed to see your imperfections and the other person who has that rare window into who you actually are and actually grow from that instead of being defensive and trying to fight because if you're used to people telling you how great you are, you have a spouse who says, no,
honey, not all the time.
You're not that cool. You're not that good. That can be really challenging because everyone else says the exact opposite about you.
That's why a lot of people in high positions, their marriages don't last, because they get so used to the outer persona being praised and come home and being told you're not that
good.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All you have to do is thank your wife for it. When it's honest and true, that doesn't mean you have to roll over and say she's 100% always right. If there's something, honey, I don't think you understood why I did that. You have a right to say that, too. But in general, she is the best mirror you'll ever have. Mm. And your children, of course, love you because you're daddy, not because you're a speaker or a minister. And that's what's real good.
Yeah.
That all of that public stuff means very little to them. In fact, it gets in the way. They will resent it sometimes because it keeps you from them. And they just want you. Hmm. That's the wonderful thing about children's love. It's they just want the relationship itself. I don't know if I answered your question. How recognize when the truth is being given and find the grace and the freedom to thank the person for it, insofar as it's true.
Yeah.
This is what really, on the foundational level, Jesus means by telling us to love our enemies. That's a real strange one when you think about it.
When you talk about marriage especially.
Love your... Yeah, because at that moment, she is your enemy. Do you understand? Not a cosmic
enemy. Well, because
enemy.
She's the one who's... or he is the one there who's inside of you, in your heart, in your rare, vulnerable space. And no one else can get there.
No one else can get there like she can.
Yeah. You
know? And when she sees it, dang it. You know it's probably true.
And I hate when she's right, too. When you're mad and you're like, oh, you're right, and I have nothing to say back. That's
beautiful,
terrible.
Beautiful.
Okay, let's change gears.
All right.
Let's talk about religion for a second.
All right.
Well, first of all, you have an ability to kind of float in and out of Protestant world, because us Protestants, we like you. Us Protestant evangelicals, we like you. Obviously, Catholic world, everyone loves you there, of course.
No,
right?
No, no. The right-wing Catholics hate me.
Well,
but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So you can kind of flow back and forth. And I've got this pet peeve. When people talk about religion, and I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but kind of in my world, sometimes people say, you know, I don't have religion. I've got a relationship.
Oh, yeah.
And I usually hear the people saying that they're on a stage in a building that doesn't have to pay property tax because it's deemed a religious building. And this person has their paycheck paid by people who give 501c3 nonprofit gifts that are not also tax deductible. And he probably has a nice charitable housing allowance that he is able to write off also on his taxes because guess what? He's a religious leader. And so we like to say we're not a part of a religion because of the bad side of it.
Yeah.
But we all are in the better sense of religion being like rejoining things, right? Isn't that the root of
religio, religament, reconnect? Yeah,
like that's the best of what it can be. And obviously there are ways that it gets bad. And I think you even said yourself that religion produces the best of people and the worst of people. And so that's why people want to say, I've got a relationship, not religion, because they see the worst of people being produced. Yeah. What do you think separates the good religion that creates the best of people and the bad religion that creates the worst of people?
Well, first of all, this is a new language. It's been around pretty strongly for almost 20, 30 years now, most of your life, because we started seeing the downside of organized religion. Now, in itself, that's good. That's moving into the deconstruction, necessary deconstruction stage. But what you're pointing out, if I'm hearing you correctly, is there's also some naivete in it. When you're still enjoying the benefits of what organized religion has given you, educated you in, the support system, like this building I'm in, I have a staff here of 17 people.
It's a wonderful facility.
Yeah, and it's they're all making my voice possible that it gets out. And they do all the work and I get all the praise. It doesn't seem fair at all in the least. So you could say on a very small scale here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, this little adobe building is religion. Now I can walk out and look like the superhero and talk about the relationship. And that should be the centerpiece, I admit. But there's some intellectual and emotional dishonesty when we refuse to admit what I'm going to use religious language, the incarnate, embodied part of the relationship.
So let's unpack that.
The incarnation is our Christian word for the enfleshment of God in Christ. That spirit needs embodiment. Spirit needs enfleshment. The eternal Christ needed a body, and it became Jesus. Mm-hmm. That would be my belief. And I think it's the same thing for enduring gospel. Let me bring it home here again. I'm 72 now. I got to be realistic. I don't have that many years left. I don't know what they are. But we talk at board meetings. What would happen to this place if Richard would be hit by a car and die tomorrow? Would it last without... So you can make a message depend on charismatic personalities, and then it dies when that personality dies. Or the only other way you can sustain a message is to organize it in such a way that a group carries and sustains the message after the death of the charismatic leader. Very many groups don't succeed 3 to 5 years after the death of the leader. So what I'm saying, what I'm building up to, is institutionalization, in my opinion, embodiment, incarnation, is to some degree necessary for the sustaining, the continuity, the ongoing truth and authority of any message. Otherwise, you simply have to wait for another charismatic personality to come along. I remember visiting ashrams in India, where literally, when the guru dies, they're empty. There's the windows are all open, the doors are all open, and there would be one guardsman taking charge of the place, and he'd say, "We're waiting for another guru to appear."
Really?
Now, that's the Eastern approach, which doesn't idealize institution the way we do.
Yeah.
We want authority and continuity and sustainability. So we put all our eggs in the institutional basket. And now you know this as a minister, sometimes we don't have any charismatic personalities who really have the ability to communicate the message anymore. That's particularly true in the Catholic Church, where you can be a completely boring preacher and be a priest, you know, but you just do the priest thing. So here's what I want to end with is the ideal is when you, and you see it in some of the letters of Paul, where you can have the balance between organization and charismatic authority. Mm-hmm. It seldom achieves a perfect balance, where you can honor the person with the special gift, but not base everything around them. Mm-hmm. If it is the true gospel, it should be sustainable by documents and practices and rituals, which become the Methodist Church or the Lutheran Church or whatever it might be. But then, within a generation, it needs reform again. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that the American Revolution, if it would be sustained, would need to be repeated every 25 years.
Really?
Yeah, he's seldom quoted on that. And what you pretty soon have is, no offense, is the daughters of the American Revolution, who are anything but revolutionary. Do you understand?
But they're holding to the...
But yeah, they're holding to the initial revolution.
Not the idea.
200 years ago. But they're, I think, I actually don't know any daughters of the American Revolution, but they tend to be, I think, highly conservative people who want to sustain the status quo. They're not interested in any kind of revolution, even though it all started with idealizing a revolution.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because this is the pattern everywhere. Yeah, this is the pattern.
That's a struggle because you get an organization, you have a church, and they always kind of regress towards maintaining status quo.
Status quo.
All spirituality, it's about letting go, getting rid of stuff. Organizations kind of shift and focus towards, naturally gravitate towards maintenance.
Self-maintenance.
You've talked about how we need to program for change and growth.
Yeah.
So that doesn't happen. What do you think that looks like if you're someone who's leading a church?
Well, let me say it's not easy to do. Because institutions, as institutions, tend to not be capable of high-level altruism. They're concerned with self-maintenance, self-congratulation, self-perpetuation, mm-hmm. self-validation. That's the definition of an institution. So you see why a person like we have Pope Francis now, who's the ultimate establishment figure, operating in an ultimately non-establishment way. It's blowing the mind of the whole world. Because I don't know, in Catholic history, I don't know if we've ever had this before, that someone can speak altruistically at the top. Because normally when you're the head of something, you've got to maintain it. You got to be what we call a company man.
Yeah.
You got to be, or you won't be reelected. Well, fortunately, the Pope isn't elected, so he knows he can say exactly what he wants to say.
That's got
to
be nice.
But few of us have that freedom.
Yeah.
Few of us have that freedom. So this is the conflict between what's good about institutions, what's very limited about their possibilities. And I say this actually so I can, and you can, be less angry and judgmental at the limited ability institutions have to initiate true change. What they can do is they can write documents that are high-minded. They can raise up individuals, like I've been protected by the Franciscans all my 45 years from bishops wanting to close me down and shut me up. And the Franciscans always step in and say, no, he's preaching the gospel.
Really?
Now, oh, yeah. If I wouldn't have had their protection, I would have been stopped 30 years ago easily, you know. Now, most people don't have that level of protection. And so what do they got to do? Be a company man, speak the party line, even when in their heart of hearts they know it isn't the gospel. Do you understand?
Wow.
Like, I want to love this gay couple. I know they love Jesus. I know they're committed to the gospel. But I can't. I just can't. I'll lose my job. Do you understand?
Because they don't have people who are... Yeah, I think about that kind of in the polity that I'm used to, where if the elders aren't behind you, you might feel called to do something. You might feel like this is the direction the church needs to go. But if you don't have the eldership support, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
And so you have that in the Franciscans.
I have that, yeah. See, that's the way the Catholic Church survived. I know you picture us, rightly so, as a big pyramid, Pope, cardinals, archbishops, bishops, priests, deacons. And that's true, but it's only half the truth. You've heard, well, you just mentioned Franciscans. Picture around the pyramid a whole bunch of satellite groups, Carmelites, Dominicans, Sisters of Mercy, Sisters of Charity, Franciscans, Jesuits. We've always had a different agenda, really, than the Catholic Church. It was the only way the Catholic Church could, this would interest a three, I would think, could managerially survive, that it was too wooden, it was too rigid. And so basically we Franciscans do our Franciscan thing. On the edge of the pyramid, we send incense toward the bishop in Rome, but we don't really quote them that much. I hope that's not shocking to you. But once you're inside, you know that's true. And that's why bishops sometimes don't like us very much, but they can't do much about it. And I'm going to be honest, like you were honest with me. Why? Because the people tend to like us more than the bishops.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he's a Jesuit or a Franciscan or a Dominican, you tend to know, you know.
You're like Robin Hood.
We're the exhaust valve.
Yeah.
We fill in all the gaps in the church. We don't tend to run the parishes.
Yeah.
So the people don't expect from us the party line answer. Like we Franciscans used to be famous for hearing confessions. People would come to us because they knew we wouldn't be harsh. Mm-hmm. You know, that we were always told to be merciful and taught to be understanding of people's mistakes. And that became our public persona. And it was very often true.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. If you ever read Angela's Ashes, you probably didn't, about what it was like to grow up Irish and Catholic. And there's this dear Franciscan who hears this little boy's teenage confession, and it breaks open his heart, you know.
Oh.
So that's our good image.
Guys.
That's our good image.
Oh,
we have our mistakes, too.
Well, yeah. I like your image. That's good stuff. Okay, there's something you said earlier that we definitely have to talk about.
All right.
Because it kind of scares me as a Protestant.
What?
You talked about the cosmic Christ.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now, I've done some reading on this. You have the idea that, like in the synoptics, you have Jesus the micro, like Jesus of Nazareth. But if you go to maybe more Paul and John, you have the eternal Christ mystery, the macro.
That's right.
Okay. You got to unpack that. I know you talked to Colossians. Did you go to the Christ in
Colossians, Ephesians, and the prologue to John's Gospel.
Okay. Ephesians.
Those are the three big first chapters that reveal the cosmic Christ. That was much more our Franciscan Christology.
Okay.
Was this, and why? Because if you know anything about the life of Francis, he wasn't an educated man. He wasn't a theologian. He was an intuitive Italian layman genius, spiritually speaking. And he spoke, this would sound New Age, if I'd say, you know, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, Sister Fox, Brother Duck. Mm-hmm. The whole universe was relational. It was brother and sister. It was one cosmic mystery of Christ. So the early Franciscan philosophers, building on that, we developed an alternative orthodoxy. We were never called heretics because it was too much in the scriptures. But it was just paying attention to different things. And I must admit that almost all mainline Protestant theology, without realizing it, basically accepted the mainline Catholic positions on things. The atonement and the divinity of Christ, the virgin birth and all these things that, you know, would sort of be mainline Catholic teaching are unquestioned. For all Protestants thought they reformed us, in many ways they're just like us.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, with a little window dressing change here or there. We were truly much more an alternative in the 13th century. But you couldn't rebel in the 13th century. The only church in the West was the Catholic Church. So you found a way to emphasize your different things, as I said, on the edge. So we did that with Christ, that we emphasized the eternal, what we eventually call the second person of the Blessed Trinity, who existed from all eternity, who took form in Jesus. So the first Bible in Franciscan theology was creation. That when God decided to manifest what's going on inside of God, for God to show himself, that was the world. Let there be light.
Okay.
The second day, the third day, the fourth day, the animals, the trees, the seas, the waters, the fish. This is the first Bible for Franciscans. Now, okay. If you want a scripture,
Romans 1:20.
Oh, you got it.
I
know
where you're going.
Romans 1:20.
For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities. Yet, we got that. Okay.
And yet, you got to admit, I got to admit that that isn't the majority of the texts. The majority of the texts are those found in the Synoptic Gospels, where we have the Jesus, the microcosm of the macrocosm, the personalization in a moment of time of what was always true. All right, God has always been compassionate, outpouring, loving, but the Word became flesh, John 1:14. Okay, that had to become manifest. You were largely told about the personal manifestation, rightly so, I mean, I was too, of the personal Jesus who was born in Bethlehem, lived and died and walked the map of the human journey for us. But for some reason, Protestant theology never grabbed on to the cosmic notion of Christ.
And so, okay, I'm trying to piece this together. First of all,
go ahead.
Thank you for giving me book, chapter, and verse, because as a Protestant, it makes me feel a whole lot more comfortable.
Well, I'm actually comfortable doing it.
Yeah. And obviously, that's part of the reason why Protestants connect to you, because you're a Bible guy.
I like it.
And so, this idea that Christ has been pre-existing, he's there from all time, and he's revealed as Jesus of Nazareth, but that's not...
You know, how Acts says it is just the opposite. You're on the right course. Jesus became the Christ.
Oh, that's right.
In the first sermons in Acts.
Acts 2, But he's now Lord and Messiah. Wasn't that the...
He was Lord.
He's something as Lord and Messiah.
And Lord and Christ.
That's and right. Christ,
revealed, named as Lord and Christ. It's said in a number of ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But are you arguing that, or is this idea that this Christ has been there all along, and so we see him in Jesus of Nazareth?
That's right.
But to say it's just that would be diminishing the fullness of the mystery of Christ.
And what gives us really the second punch for believing this is Paul's doctrine of the body of Christ. You know, Paul's great message, and I became convinced of this from N.T. Wright, by the way, that the new temple is the human person. Hmm. And N.T. Wright says that is the supreme idea of Paul. The new temple is the human person, which he then fully develops in the corporate person of the doctrine of the body of Christ, 1 Corinthians 12. Mm-hmm. It's the incarnation taken to its logical end.
Okay, you're really doing a number on me, because two things I can't disagree with. One, book, chapter, and verse, and the other is Tom Wright.
No.
So when you're using both of those, it's really hard for me to have a case to argue against, because it makes so much sense.
Yeah, it really does. It's good stuff. And I promise you, please don't be afraid, this will no way lessen your love or appreciation for the absolute meaning of Jesus in human history. It will, in fact, multiply it tenfold. And let me tell you just a very practical reason. If in the next decade we discover on these 60 billion planets there's life on other planets, statistically it's very likely. I'm not a necessary believer in that. I'm not a disbeliever in that. But let's just, for the sake of discussion, say it happens.
Okay.
If we limit Jesus to this planet, to what happened in this world 2,000 years ago, the Christian religion is going to be in for major problems. Huh? Because did Jesus save this other world? Was it necessary? Did they sin? Did he die for their sins? The whole thing is too much a tribal religion, unless you recognize that Christ is Jesus' eternal name and cosmic name, and not his last name, which is the way we see it.
Okay, so the other option is to think that there was once a Martian Jesus who was out on some alien planet, or we could just think that God is...
Well, that the eternal Christ could have taken many manifestations. I'm not a believer in that. I'm not trying to push toward a belief in aliens or something. I'm really not. Even though you're near Roswell, New Mexico, I don't. But,
I was wondering if you meant Area 51 too long.
But we logically, theologically, have to accept that God could have taken millions of manifestations. The eternal Christ could have taken many manifestations.
You say Jesus' resurrection is not a one-time miracle of bodily resuscitation as much as a needed drama to focus our attention on a presence that has always been available since the beginning.
Yeah. Do you see how this takes away from these people who want to deny the resurrection? I'll end up, if you stay with me, very conservative Christian. I believe in the bodily resurrection of Christ. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's absolutely necessary because God loves the amalgam of body and spirit. He doesn't just raise up spirit. He raises up body, new heaven and new earth. So now the resurrection of Christ is no big surprise, of Jesus, is no big surprise. Because, of course, the Christ is eternal. And this Christ mystery went through this very real drama of death. But resurrection was inevitable, certain, of course.
Yeah.
And as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, what happened in him is a foretaste and promise and guarantee of what's going to happen to all of us, to the whole universe. So Jesus is the map, the almost perfect map of what's going to happen in every human life and in human history. And in the final chapter is resurrection and ascension. Return to where we started.
Wow.
Return to God.
If someone asks you to spell out what that looks like, the last chapter, how do you describe it? How do you define? We're running out of time.
No, we're not. I forgive me for looking at my watch.
No.
I'm enjoying talking to you thoroughly.
Well, we've done an hour and 50. I've never done a podcast over an hour, so this is...
Oh, no, I'm glad to talk to you. But what did you just ask
me? Okay, so if someone's going to ask you, what does the final chapter look like?
Well, first of all, I'd have to be true to my biblical notion of belief and say, I don't know.
Okay.
All right, but I believe what we refer to very often glibly as the second coming of Christ. I believe whenever human beings see this confluence of divine spirit in the material universe, Christ has come again. Right? Whenever we bring that to consciousness, when you adore your little girls and thank God for giving them to you, that's a moment of the return of Christ. Do you understand? Now, I'm not denying that there might well be such a thing as described in the Gospels of the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine, but I don't know. I don't know. I do know that Christ is coming again and again and again and again. But the general belief of the tradition, the perennial tradition, was that all of these smaller lives were going to coalesce into one great history. You look at history right now and you say, my gosh, it sure doesn't look like we're getting closer to unitive consciousness, does it? Almost the more we move forward, the more the pushback seems to show itself. So I don't know what the final moment of history. You know, there just in the last month, there have been scientists who are saying that they believe the universe is eternal.
What? I thought it was going to explode and our Earth was going to run into the sun.
I don't know science, but that was argued about in the 13th century. Is the universe eternal? Now, remember, you and I can't think that. We don't know how to think any notion of eternal. But is this mystery, if God is eternal, then God's manifestation could well be eternal, which is creation,
mm-hmm.
which could mean the Christ is forever coming again. But is there an evolution of Christian consciousness? We have to say there is. I mean, slavery is unthinkable to us now.
Yeah.
And yet it wasn't as little as 150 years ago.
That's amazing to think.
It really is amazing. And so human beings are becoming more like Christ, little by little by little. And yet, the closer we get to it, it almost feels like there's more opposition to it, really.
Interesting.
But thank you for staying with me and not thinking I'm saying more than I'm saying or less than I'm saying, because it is revolutionary for the typical mainline Catholic and for the Protestant, because almost no Protestant theology was creation-centered.
Yeah. Right?
It was all based in words. Remember, the printing press was coterminous with Luther. Right? Mm-hmm.
We don't have the Reformation without the ability to read books.
Without books. But, and this will help you be more patient with the first 1,500 years. Remember, most Catholics couldn't read, right? They couldn't read or write. And we chained the Bible to the cathedral wall because it took a year to copy one.
Wow.
And the only people who could read were the clergy. So that's why we have these stained glass windows and these statues, I know, which all look pagan to you. But they reflect that first 1,500 years. For good and for ill. It's not all bad.
No.
Yeah. Just, and same with the written word of the Bible. Thank God for the written word. Thank God. But we got to know, here's non-dual thinking. There's a good side to it and there's a bad side to it. You know that now we're trapped in words. And we argue about words because words are oppositional.
Mm-hmm.
They're made to distinguish this from that.
Yeah, right. So the word became flesh.
We
like to return the favor and
there
flesh
we go.
Right back into word.
Into the word.
Did I steal that from you? I probably
did.
I've
said it, but others have said it. Others have said it.
That's the problem. I've read too much of your stuff. I don't know it's your idea and what I stole from you and Tom Wright and whoever.
Nah.
But hey, this has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
It has been a lot of fun. So thank you so much.
You're a lot of fun. Thank you, Luke.
And by the way, we talked on the phone once a year ago
or something like that.
And you at one point referred to me as cute on the phone call. And I just want to say thank you for not calling me cute again this time.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.